So I just did a podcast with Murray from Advantage Business, and it's going to be a useful podcast for people that are curious about leadership and want to create a framework or take their business to the next level, especially if you're a small to medium-sized business. You find yourself in a challenging position as you transition from being a technician to removing yourself and supporting the business grow as opposed to being the person that makes the business grow. So, if that's interesting to you and you get value out of it, by all means, listen on. And if you want a free book on how to achieve financial freedom in New Zealand, there's a link in the description. And without further ado, let's kick into it. Before I start any podcast, I think it's always useful to set the scene, shall we say. So sort of a little bit about your business and what you do within it and how that works and that sort of thing.
Should we just cover off the whole mask
thing? Well, we can start with the mask. That's a good point there.
Yeah. Well, look, my wife had pneumonia 20 years ago, and with opening up our borders and all the rest of it, I'm just being a bit careful. I managed to bring COVID home to the family, which made me tremendously popular. I'm just being a little bit careful. I actually hate masks.
Yeah.
But there you go, a bit of risk management.
Yeah, I think it makes for entertaining content too, especially like when we do the little clips out of context.
Yeah, that's right.
So aside from the mask, we've got that out of the way. What do you do and what does the business do?
Sure. So I'm a director and shareholder in Advantage Business. And Advantage Business has been around since 1998, which make it 24 years. And we are passionate about what we call SME businesses and business owners, small to medium enterprise, and some of them aren't that small. The work that I do with businesses tends to be from about $1 million revenue through $70 million, that's per annum revenue, across a whole range of industries. The business advisory profession, because it is a profession, to be any good at it, you normally have to have had an in-depth business background, and you've got to have credibility and validity and have done things and be continuously learning. So just to put that into context, New Zealand's economy is about $400 billion, which sounds a lot, and it is for New Zealand. It's not that much globally, but it matters, 5 million people. And SME businesses are about $69 billion out of $400 billion. So SME businesses matter. And they employ a lot of people. But unlike the corporate world, they tend to be a little bit short of time, sometimes resource, certainly over the last couple of years, some talent, sometimes cash flow or working capital. So SME business owners and the ones I work with, they're always absolutely brilliant at certain things. Sometimes two or three things. So why would they need a business advisor? Well, there's a range of reasons. First of all, they need to be open to that. Being an owner, a business owner in New Zealand, is really quite lonely and relatively difficult. So if somebody has more of a technical bent or genius, they may or may not have access to the leadership and management side of things, and that's where we come in, that's where I come in. And I guess in terms of my own validity, I was 27 years in corporate, both here and offshore, in a range of financial and commercial areas, but also general management and CEO areas. 17 years ago after that, I decided to commit to helping SME businesses, which is what I've done ever since, and it's what I do, and I'm passionate about it. So I help the 69 billion do things they need to do. SME business owners deserve, in my opinion, a lot better rap than they get, because not only is it difficult to be a good one, but if they're successful in New Zealand, not that many of the owners actually court much public opinion, but in fact they're looking after, you imagine the number of families that are dependent upon the success of a business in the SME space. It's tens and tens of thousands of people. So it matters. And what I saw in my time in corporate, not to run corporate down, but corporate's got plenty of cash and plenty of access to many resources, but tends to manipulate some of that at times and not necessarily be honest all the time for a range of reasons. Whereas in the SME world, honesty is a given, and the way that an SME business comes across in the market has to be very, very clear. But a lot of those SME businesses are short of certain resource, sometimes including certain areas of access to the market. And it could be funding, it could be leadership, it could be a range of areas. So I don't know everything. I've been around a business now for quite a while, over 40 years. I know quite a bit, but I've got a network to help. And that's the way we roll, that's the way we operate. And it's rather cool because we get to help these SME businesses, and that's basically what we do.
Yeah, I love, I'm more of the psychology bent, where I like unpacking and understanding what led to people's, you know, career and purpose. So I'm wondering if, like, you know, you're playing around with your toys and you're like 5 years old and you're suddenly like, you know what, I'm going to manage businesses. Like, what was your childhood like, or what was your high school like? Or,
oh yeah, okay, probably without going too far back, I actually did a degree. It was commerce and law, in the 70s, and I worked in a warehouse while I did that. So I was in the real world on the warehouse floor packing groceries. While I got my training at university. So I guess I was there part-time to some extent, although it was pretty full-on, and hit the marketplace late 70s. With a degree in no knowledge. So it was all about acquiring knowledge from there. I managed to get my first mentor 10 years after that. It took me 10 years to find the right person. But effectively, I've always been quite driven. It's probably something in my genes. It goes back to a couple of areas of my family where business has always been a practical fascination for me. And so one thing led to another, really. And if you're in corporate, particularly and you're young, you tend to earn opportunities. You don't get anything, you earn opportunities. And if you've got the right attitude and you're prepared to really go the extra mile, you'll tend to get somewhere.
Yeah, I'll go mad. The only corporate I ever dealt with was McDonald's, and I tried to change the system, I just had a trial for a day, and then they gave me free food and let me go.
Good on you. Well, yeah, changing the system probably wasn't going to work. But
no.
I think the key thing became fairly evident to me early on that success was actually about people. I did learn that lesson fairly early. It wasn't about technical things so much. It was about people.
Yeah.
Business is about people, much more than it's about any particular business discipline. The business disciplines have to be there, but without people, no business is going to operate. So over time, I got into some leadership roles, which was quite scary, particularly the first one, and built from there, and sometimes help businesses through changes in the marketplace.
What was scary about that first one?
Oh, the scary thing about it was that I was quite young, and I was so-called in charge of a lot of people who were a lot older than me, some of which had a lot more experience.
Yeah.
And so I needed to get over, I think the term is imposter syndrome, but it was in my head. It wasn't so much in everybody else's. I mean, people judge somebody on what they can do, and as long as they're not not the kind of person that they don't want to deal with. There's some empathy with people that's needed. people have got to know that someone may well be smart, may well be able to do things that they actually care.
Yeah.
So that was really from there. My progression became less about, if you like, technical function and management, more about leadership and more about helping a business actually get somewhere and inspiring people.
Just on that, like the younger leading older, that's been an interesting dynamic. Like, I never look at it leading, I just see it as supporting. But what is your advice after going through that yourself? Let's say there's a young person listening that's leading people that are older than them. How do you navigate that? What you should be mindful of?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the first thing, and it's hard first time up, is to actually be yourself. Now, it might sound a simple thing to say, but if you're yourself, your authentic self, and you've got something to say and people can see that you can make a difference, then they'll accept that actually very quickly. There'll always be a few people who won't, who are a prisoner of their own views of what's right in the world. But really, results and looking after people and helping people achieve things tends to very quickly become center stage. Really, the battle in your first role is with your own self-esteem. Part of you saying, well, am I good enough? Am I smart enough? Am I this? Am I that? And either that overwhelms you, or you focus on things and say, right, well, this is what I need to do. I'll do it. I'll be me. And the first few times you get a bit of borax, it's probably good for you in one way. You toughen up a little bit.
Mm.
But then it's like anything. Business, to some extent, is a little bit like sports. I've played a lot of sports, but in the end, you look at any top sports, man, sports woman, people don't see in their effortless performance at a high level all the work that went into that. And so when somebody in business or in sport, they have a certain amount of success and they get into a bigger pool, mm-hmm. they have some more success. Confidence comes from success over time. And it builds. And you see that in people. And when I work with a leader and they're a little bit unsure, we work together, they're less unsure, they find their feet. And then it's not a spreadsheet, thank heavens. It's a kind of an exponential process. But part of it too is people can tell a phony. In the end, if you lead a team of people or a person or a group of people, they won't actually remember much about what you said, or technically they'll remember how they felt. And how they felt, and a subscript to that is what was achieved, is what will stay with them. And so if you think about it yourself, Ryan, you think back to the best team you've ever been part of, you think back to the best leader you've ever worked with, probably in the top of your mind will actually be how you felt. And that's there's a lot of psychology and a lot of discipline around that. But in the end, our feelings actually matter. People, you know how people talk about gut feel?
Mm.
I'll just mention, so we take in the world through our head, through our heart to our gut. We make decisions from the gut through the heart to the head. So we take in the world vertically, and we make decisions the other way. You think about it. You think about any decision you've ever made, one that really mattered. The first thing, you've got a feeling in the pit of your stomach. Maybe it's a pretty sort of warm, pleasant feeling, feels good. Or it's the opposite, doesn't feel good. And so leadership's quite a lot about that, not only between your head, heart, and gut, but everybody else's. Some people ask me, well, is there a magic formula to get people to buy into something? No, there isn't. It absolutely isn't a magic formula. There never was and there never will be. Good leaders and great leaders are able to practically inspire people. People feel in the pit of their stomach that whatever they're saying actually is true.
Mm.
And everybody likes that. You know, all of us, we can pick any person that we're interested in any field of being human. And it always comes to the back to the same thing. Why was someone a great leader? Well, what they said was true. It helped me. It did things. And ultimately, that's what almost anybody wants to achieve in life. We probably, anyone who's in leadership roles, they don't want to sit around and have the next cup of coffee. That's nice. So they're there for a reason.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of leaders that come in with good intent but go about it the wrong way. So, for example, like the motivational component, I mean, I think that starts from hiring, where you're hiring people based on their vision and their values, and you've got a vision and you're not telling them to like your vision. Your vision actually accommodates theirs, so then they're motivated by themselves instead of by you.
Mm.
What would you say to a business owner that says, oh, my staff aren't motivated as me, and they, you know, they're lazy or whatever? Or how would you encourage them either to reframe it, to view it in a better way, or to actually motivate staff?
Well, I think the reality there in a situation like that, as you said, it comes back to the recruitment decision, actually. What were people recruited on the basis of attitude? Were they recruited on the basis of personality and fit as well as technical skills? Or were they recruited on the basis of this is the person I can get? But the next thing, it's like anything. You don't put a nice shrub or whatever in a garden. You know, humans aren't shrubs. But if you've got somebody in a business or a group of people in a business, they need nurturing. And one way they need the leader to get out of the way and let them get on with it. But they need support. But it's support in a way each person wants. So when I hear, oh, you know, my people are this, people are that, and usually something's broken. It could be as simple as people who've been either recruited or placed in the wrong roles. It could be the way that they're managed and led. It could be the style of the leader. Or there could have just been some plain bad hires where some people came into the business and didn't want to be there. Now, our role in that area is to help the owner identify what the real issues are and then look to plan to do something about it and execute on that, you know, do something. So it's quite cool. Here we are in 2022, and I like to call myself attitudinally 36. I'm obviously not chronologically 36. But I think the key thing there, there's a range of tools, but there's some really fantastic tools which can be used around people, and I'll mention one. We use a thing called Reach Ecosystem. And that's what that enables to do without going into any detail. It's obviously software, but it's quite visual, and it enables a person to actually take control of where they're at and start to understand how they can improve, and they can actually see their improvement over time.
Hmm.
Now, that kind of software really only has existed in the last maybe 10 years, probably more like 5 to 10 years. But it's really neat because it's one of the IT side of things that have gone well. One thing that really used to annoy me is if you had, say, a business, particularly in corporate, and there might be, say, 1,000 people, so 10% of that's 100, but let's say the top 20 people in that 1,000 got all the resources of training and development, etc. The next maybe 80 got about 10% of that, and everybody else didn't get any.
Yeah.
And so something like Reach enables, because it's quite cost effective and quite scalable, every person in a business, and the businesses I work with tend to be somewhere from probably 20 people through to maybe a couple of hundred, sometimes a bit more. So something like that tool can reach every person, and it comes back to what I talked about before, their head, their heart, and their gut. In their gut, they know they've got some issues. They know they want to improve. They're not sure how. And even when they grasp the how, that's called training. Any trainer will tell you that within a couple of weeks, 90% of whatever was trained has been forgotten. You've got to live it.
Yeah.
So this tool enables people to start actually doing something about it. If they're motivated, it doesn't take a lot of effort. And the results are amazing, particularly if you had, say, a group of 10 people all doing this or more.
Yeah.
It really does make a difference. And you can see it. It's almost like lighting a positive wildfire. Such a thing. I mean, just the analogy is, if somebody starts a fire in the middle of a bone dry forest, it's gonna go. So this is a good fire. It's not a fire. This is starting something, and people talk. Gee, have a look at this. This is really neat. People like that. I mean, people are primarily sociable.
It's interesting. I haven't heard of Reach. But I think there's an important component where, like, whether it's, you know, this is a bit trite comparing it to, but whether it's love language, whether it's a framework of communication, whether it's a personality test to categorize people so you know how to deal with them a little better, I think there's a lot of people that might not feel comfortable in the EQ or the people component that would gravitate towards a systemized way to communicate.
That's exactly right. So look, we'll get off Reach in a minute, but the reality is that it starts with an assessment, but many tools finish with that. That's just the start with this, because it's a process of some self-discovery, and it's quite safe. It doesn't have to be shared with anyone else until the person's ready. But there's a whole framework which I won't go into now. But it's a simple, elegant, powerful framework, and to help people realize their own potential.
So just on that, like whether it's Reach or something else, like the leader that's transitioning from being that technician to be more of the people-orientated approach, whether I think part of being a good owner is recognizing that you're not the right person for the job sometimes, but how does someone transition from that traditional tech technician to more of the let's grow and not be so dependent on me for some good steps?
You've put your finger on one of the major issues in business in New Zealand and offshore and in SME. And so it's actually, this comes back to nature and nurture, the good old argument. If you've got someone who's technically excellent or superb, for them to move into leadership, first of all, they've got to want to do that. That's very important. In fact, it's actually critical. But secondly, outside of their technical expertise, or part of them as a person, they've got to, some extent, I'd say like people, it sounds a bit trite, but they've got to have a certain level of people skills. And what does that mean? Well, it depends. I'll just cover off the extrovert-introvert thing. In my opinion, Western civilization is built on a faulty premise that 80% of people are extroverts. The reality is that the mix of extrovert-introvert is about 59-41. It might as well be 50-50. So you think about it, if it's been set up as if 80% are extroverts, the system says, well, 30% of people have got a problem because they're introverts, not extroverts. Now, there's nothing broadcasting that. It's far more subtle than that. But in people's minds and hearts and gut, they think, well, I'm expected to do all these things. And I don't want to. I don't want to make a big noise. I don't want to go rah, rah. I prefer my own company at times over others. I don't need to do all that. Does that mean there's something wrong with me? This is what goes on in the heads of people. And quite a number of technically competent people, not all, but quite a number are introverts.
Mm.
So I'm very fortunate to work with, I have and I do, and I will work with some really talented leaders. Some of those leaders are out and out extroverts. Some of them are the exact opposite. They're introverts and quite introverted. But whether they make noise or not, they're effective. So I'll give you a strange analogy. And the analogy is sheepdogs. And the leaders aren't sheepdogs. The reason I mention that, there's two kinds of dog. There's a Huntaway dog and an eye dog. So the eye dog's like the black and white collie, a bit like, think of a Footrot's Flats dog. That's, you know, dog called dog. That's an eye dog. It virtually never barks.
Yeah.
Whereas a Huntaway is a large Huntaway dog, and it goes woof, 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 woof. It woofs a lot. So it moves, makes things happen. It happens to be sheep, but it's just an analogy. It makes a lot of noise, or it's quite extroverted. An eye dog is reacting. So you might say, and it's a long bow, but the extrovert side of things is a bit Huntaway, and the introvert's more eye. So when you have a, what I've seen with leaders who've moved from technical to leadership, again, rule one, which is always the rule, they're still themselves. What happens, and maybe they've always done this, or maybe they've thought about it and got some training, they can influence people, either in a very extroverted way or introverted. And people, first of all, know that A, they're competent, B, they care, C, they're honest and they've got integrity, and whatever they ask anyone to do, they could do themselves. Maybe not necessarily technically with everything, but they're there. It's kind of like the captain of a male or female sports team. The captain, all the players know that the captain's, if not the absolute best player, they're certainly a good player, but they're also a team player. So what you've hit on there, Ryan, is a very, very important thing. And the sad thing I see sometimes is, let's say it was yourself, Ryan, let's say you're a fantastic fitter and welder in a business, or yeah, or an architect, yeah, or an engineer, or a sailor. Let's just say you're an architect, and you were one of the best architects your firm had ever had, and then one day somebody calls you in somewhere and says, righto, Ryan, we want you now to lead this team.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, yeah, what do you want me to do? Well, we want you to do this and this and that. And how many people I'm going to be leading? Oh, not many, just 35. And you go out of there thinking, oh, hold on. A, I didn't sign up for that. I'm an architect. I like being an architect. I like everything to do with it. I like the technical side of it. I like the creative side of it. And I get a kick out of putting plans in front of a client, either myself or as a team. And they like it, and I really get a kick out of seeing it when it's built. Now I have to do all this leadership stuff, and I'm not sure I know what to do. So straight away in comes the, oh, phony. I'm not a phony architect, but what's all this leadership carry on?
Mm.
Mm. I mean, we've talked a lot about leadership today, and I'm quite happy to do that. There's other things, but we'll stay on it because someone who's a leader, when they get really good at it, because they're so authentic and because it suits their personality, it's really deep in them and people feel that. So in one way, they haven't got anything to prove, but the key thing is that the people in their team develop. And you would have heard from many leaders at a high level. First thing, usually the question to a leader is, well, how come the leadership's so good in your business? How do you do it? And the first thing they'll tend to say is, well, I recruit and we recruit. I want people in my team that are better than me. I want all of them to be better than me. So what that person means is, as a technical level, But they're not, it's not so much an attitude, it's similar levels of attitudes, different perspectives. But what happens there is the result, the sum's greater than the parts. So if you had 10 people and they're each fantastic, you put them together, it's more like 30 people, except it's 10. It's not anyone working harder, it's working smarter. And it's people, it's just everyone's getting something out of it. Interesting, just for you haven't mentioned it, but people sometimes think it's about money. Money is important, but it's a demotivator. Money is important to many people at many stages, but it's not all there is. There's other things as well. And some people in teams, for various reasons, they're not there working for money. Yes, they get money, but they're working for other things.
Yeah, well, I interviewed a recruitment agent a little while ago, and funnily enough, he talked about the companies with the best culture pay less.
Well, it's interesting. Certainly, some of the best cultures sometimes do pay a little bit less, but over time, probably not that much. I think the key thing is that people feel it more. They feel more positive.
Yeah. So it's not so much that the leadership isn't showing appreciation and supporting them. It's more a reflection of the intangible aspects of their role they find more enjoyable, whereas the other competitors have to sell on money because they don't have that healthy culture.
I think that's very true. That's very true. And that's on the wrong premise that all anybody wants is money. If somebody's really unhappy in their role or unhappy in their role and able to move, and they're getting really good money, they'll probably still move.
Yeah.
They'll probably still move because, well, if they feel they can still get good money, but have a better culture.
They also, that like even from a happiness standpoint, you know, once you reach a certain threshold, I think they did a study in Uganda and Canada, the two extremes. So they said, once you reach a certain threshold of income, the thing that gives you more value is actually helping and supporting others as opposed to making more money.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the underplayed aspects of leadership in organizations is that they think money is the solution when the actual underlying motives of the individual and what's important to them will motivate them more than the actual money itself. So when we used to do recruitment, we'd do a similar to a value proposition sale, was where you would ask them what's important to them, what would they enjoy in a role, and that varied. You know, it could be, I want to go on these trips and learn more. I want to grow my own team. I want to be able to provide for my family. I want a sense of achievement. And depending on what they say, you can tailor a role provided that they're doing a superpower your organization needs. So I think that's an underplayed component in leadership is actually hiring people that love what they do and accommodating what makes that enjoyable for them, as opposed to just paying them more?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe we might come back to that. I just wouldn't mind covering a couple of other things if I could. I want to cover funding, not at a technical level, but at a summary level. And I also want to cover IT systems.
Oh, yeah.
Because IT systems are so pervasive. You name me, any business that doesn't have it at its heart, besides its people, a number of IT systems to make it run. So I'll just cover funding first. My first comment around funding, and I'm talking about what's known as debt funding, in other words, mainly bank funding. There is equity funding, and that's bringing in equity partners, but it's on the debt funding side of things. A good business is probably going to be earning a reasonably good return on its investment. It's known as shareholders' funds, and if they're able to get access to the right information and which to enable them to talk to a bank, then they'll probably end up getting the finance that they need. Now people talk about how hard that is, but I've been doing that for a long time. Probably close to 40 years now, right through changes in banking, and the right information and the right case is needed.
Mm.
But cash never goes out of fashion. Any size business in any industry needs working capital so that it can do all the things it needs to do. So In the SME world, I come across a number of businesses that need better funding, either more funding or better structured funding. So that's a hitchhiker's galaxy to funding, leaving out all the technicalities. There are plenty, but I don't want to talk about any of those. The other side of things is IT systems. I do quite a lot of system work with clients. So I'll give you an example. A client of mine that I help in a range of spaces. They're quite large. They're about 50 people. They're not small. And they've got plans over the next 7 years to grow a lot more. And they've identified that they need some better systems. So I've had system experience from the point of view of a user. At one stage, I actually worked for a major system vendor, the people that sell in and scope the systems. Mm. And at times with my leadership roles, I've been the person with their privates on the line being accountable for the successful implementation of a system. So nowadays, what I'll do is be involved with owners to help them select the right system, help them work with the vendor, work with the team, and make sure that all the preparation required and then the process of getting the system in and operating occurs. And I don't want to go to the next level of detail, but I think the key thing with that, it's really a leadership challenge all on its own. There are plenty of stories of that whole process of system implementation going badly. So it's a bit like recruitment. Either the wrong system was selected, or the many tasks and the project of getting it into the system was undercooked and people weren't buying into it. So that's a recipe for disaster. And when those things don't work, it probably will be unsuccessful. But when they do work, there's an asset for the business. And it's very satisfying to see a business make an investment in systems, improve their systems. And again, it's kind of a bit like cash flow, that everything in the business works better. Because we're in 2022 and beyond, so making money from surprising and delighting customers and having good systems enables service, enables you know, all those sort of things. So that's very once over lightly, but funding is key, systems are key, leadership is key, people is key.
Yeah, well, just on the systems thing, and then we can get into funding again. There's some doctor, I can't remember the specifics, but it's just a good analogy where people were told, you know, you're going to die if you don't change your habits in the next few years. 10% of them change their habits. I think that's an important consideration when you're bringing in a new system and you're bringing in change and navigating that, because humans resist it.
Yep.
Especially if it's a drastic change, the rate of resistance is usually proportionate to that change.
So that's right.
How do you navigate that as a leader in an organization where you get adoption, shall we say, with a new system?
Yeah, that's fantastic, Ryan. The first thing, let's just validate, humans don't like change. Yeah. You don't like change. I don't like change. Yeah. Anyone that says they actually like change is probably lying or...
cooked.
Yeah, maybe both. So the first thing is there actually a need for this new system? What are the benefits of it? And that's got to be put up first of all. There's a process of people buying into it. So first of all, to buy into it, they've actually got to appreciate the need, appreciate the objective. They've got to understand what's in it for them in terms of their roles. But they've also they don't want to be mucked around. They need to understand what the training is, how long that's going to take, and most importantly, how they're going to complete their role that they might already be busy or very busy in, and somehow find the time to be trained. In other words, will the leadership of the business give them enough of a chance to acquire those skills? And there's a technical term on that. But basically what it means is, it's around, the term is business system integration, which sounds a bit cold. But the reality is, if you look at it for each person to go, well, hold on, what's in it for the business? What's in it for me? How can I still continue to do a good job? And how much additional work am I going to have to do to get to this benefit situation? And do I want to do that or not? And every person who gets impacted by the new system, which often is right across the company, if they don't feel that it's worth it, they're going to resist.
Yeah.
They may well still grumble and resist at times, but overall, okay, no, we can see where this is. And there needs to be a process where their concerns are listened to and acted on.
Mm. No.
So it's not a spreadsheet. It's a human process, and it's around taking people on a particular journey that's very clearly defined.
Mm. Makes sense. The funding thing, I have no idea about the systems and people I enjoy. So the funding. So suddenly, you know, cash is king. It's like the blood of the business. And you need funding from the bank. What should you think about? How does that even work? And I don't know how you manage it with the banks, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll just give a bit of an overview.
Yeah.
All banks run on information. You don't simply rock up to a bank and say, "G'day, I'm Ryan, I'm Murray. Can I have X amount of money?"
Yeah, I'm used to that.
So, well, you can do that, but you're probably going to not get a very good response.
No.
So what it ends up being, the work I do in funding is because I'm a chartered accountant, have been for a long, long time. But what I'd say is I'm a reformed one. And what I mean by that is I start with the objective and with the people and what's needed. And then I will take the information the bank needs, because it's quite prescriptive what they need, and then marry that up with the information that the business can provide. Because quite often, information that a business can provide needs to be structured in a certain way so that a bank can understand it. So it's almost, to some extent, a bit like marrying two languages. There's the language of the business and the language of the bank.
Mm.
And whilst a number of people have some quite definite ideas about banks, either positive or negative, sometimes quite marked, the information that a bank needs is pretty much a given. But the funny thing about it is there's two people in banks. There's a lot of people in banks, but there's a front-end person and a back-end person. The front-end person is the relationship manager. And they represent a bank, and they work with a business, and they will state what's needed.
Mm.
It's then up to the business to get that, and I help a number of my clients with that, sometimes to quite a detailed level. But then ultimately, what happens is that information is pulled together by the front end person in terms of a proposal within the bank. And then it goes to what's called what I call the back end person, which is the credit person.
Mm.
Their role is to protect the bank's balance sheet.
Yeah.
And a very experienced banker once said to me, he said, "Look, Murray, banking's really simple. We lend out a whole lot of money and we don't want to lose any." So they're quite risk averse.
Yeah.
So they have a range of ways of looking at things. But what I find quite useful, did I mention to you the last couple of years the funding that I've put in place for clients? Did I mention that?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's before or during.
No, that's all right. So since, I'll just mention, because I've been doing this for a long time, but since March 20, I've had 32 million Kiwis signed off by banks on behalf of clients, and that's as a range from 250,000 sign off through to 6 million. The interesting thing is that even though the amount of money is different, the information was quite similar. And so banks, they want to minimize risk. And that might sound self-serving for the bank, and it is, but they also don't want businesses to take too much risk, because they don't want to have to do something nasty to them.
Mm.
So So there we go. That's banking in a nutshell. It has its place. So that's called debt finance. The other source of funding is primarily what's known as equity, which is people who have got money, sometimes high net worth, sometimes others, and they'll put money into a business without expecting an immediate return or getting interest. And sometimes that can be for 6 months, 12 months, 5 years, 10 years, and it depends on a lot of things with that. The one good thing about bank finance is the bank only wants one thing, which is to have the money repaid. And when they can see that a business can repay the money, the bank will probably be very well disposed to lend them some more if they need it. Whereas with equity funding, it's very much person dependent. It's what strings, if anything, come with that. And from business owners' point of view, that some business owners just don't want to dilute their equity, the percentage they own in a business. They'd much rather deal with a bank. Others are prepared. They may not want to deal with a bank, and they're more interested in equity. So that's a sort of personality of the business, the business owners. But overall, getting money from banks is relatively technical. But part of it is, I'll just finish this by saying, any bank will look at, let's say it was you, Ryan, let's say you were the sole shareholder in a business. A bank will look at yourself, they'll determine your honesty and your integrity and whether they want to deal with you. They'll then assess the industry risk of the business that you're in or businesses. And if they like that industry risk, they'll then say, that's cool. Here's the information we need. And so that information needs to be provided, as well as a story of where the business has been and where it's going. And that's basically how it works. But there's an art to doing that.
So on the industry part, are there some black marked industries where they're like, oh, well, I don't really
want to... that varies from time to time, but yeah. I'll give you a good example. Since COVID, it's a good one. It's not good for people in the industry, but tourism and hospitality. So I think of a particular business that I won't name, which is a very large helicopter operation, which had been operating for about 30 years in a particular location of New Zealand. And their target market was high net worth Americans, Europeans and Asians who would come in and charter a helicopter for, say, a week to either go heli skiing or shoot deer or something like that. The problem was that all of a sudden, without much warning, our borders shut and there were no more tourists. Now banks would take a look at that and go, well, the risk profile of that industry has changed. Because all of a sudden there are almost no customers. If there's no customers, there's no cash flow.
Wow. That's tough, eh? I mean,
it's incredibly tough.
Yeah, and it's applicable in the investment world. Is, you know, you can't have to be unemotional in the way that you diversify yourself, because that's an unfair thing. That's the reality of life. So is there a thing that you can do as a business owner, either instilling a culture of innovation? Because whether it's that or something else, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a business partner ripping you off and not being communicated, taking off into the, I've seen a lot of that. So is there something that you can instill in your team or your organization to encourage the protection or preservation of businesses, or you see certain attributes that lead to a business success, whereas another one might fail?
Well, I talked a moment or two ago around effectively a tourism operator.
Yeah.
The same things applied over the COVID period for hospitality, because people not being around or not being around as much. And funnily enough, Air New Zealand is another example. And in terms of most businesses are in a particular industry, some more than one industry, but they're in the industry because they know it. And so I'll just give you a couple of examples of positive examples where, and as we speak at the moment, that's the case. So one of my clients is in infrastructure in New Zealand, in a particular area of infrastructure. And New Zealand's spend on infrastructure has lagged a long way behind what's needed for actually decades. So if a business is within infrastructure, it could be engineering, it could be electricity, it could be a range of spaces. Then if they're good at what they do, the infrastructure spend is going to have to be there one way or another, whether it's at government level, at local government level, or private company level, or individual level. And so so banks look at, for example, and banks aren't the be all and end all, it's just an example in terms of risks. Each industry over time has its ebbs and flows, but infrastructure in New Zealand has probably got legs for at least the next 20, if not 30 years. Take another example, the agrarian sector, agricultural, there's various areas there. Dairy, for example, has its ups and downs. Mm. But it's a large global business for New Zealand. You've got such people as kiwi fruit growers and all manner of farming. And so when it comes to innovation, a business owner, good businesses, they invest in their people, they invest in their development, and they have a learning culture around what they're doing now, and they're always looking to decrease their risk. So I'll give you an example. One of my clients happens to be in the infrastructure area, and I've helped them pull together a joint venture between themselves and another business that and they've known the other business for a long, long time, but this joint venture is half owned by my client and half owned by the other business. But its purpose there is to develop part of the market that neither business had developed.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a term, win-win. I prefer to express it as no one loses. So there are ways to grow businesses. What I'm seeing over the last couple of years is certain businesses that are doing well, they may look to acquire some other businesses in their industries who aren't doing so well or who want to sell out. And that's a commercial, that's not the strong buying up the weak as such, but it could be for health reasons, it could be a whole range of reasons. So the terms use rationalization, which sounds a bit cold. The reality is that businesses do over time acquire other businesses if there's a reason.
That's true. Well, believe it or not, we've done 53 minutes. So I'm just wondering, in terms of a leaving thought, or maybe there's a young, inspiring management consultant or even a business owner that's, you know, a bit overwhelmed and haven't heard this concept of management consultant, what would your imparting comment would be, and then how do they find you if they want?
Oh, okay. Well, I go by the term business advisor.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just semantics. It's advising an owner, first of all, listening to where they're at and helping them craft the future, working with them. In terms of how to find me, I have a mobile number. I have an email. I can give that to you, or I can say it now if you like. I don't mind which.
Yeah, we'll post it.
Yeah, that's fine. But I think it's important that any owner looking at an external person, a business advisor or anyone else, They've got to feel they can work with the person. They've got to feel that not only has the person got validity, but they're actually a decent person. And there's some degree of fit between the owner and the advisor. That's really important. Mm. And today I've done a lot of talking. One of the key attributes regarding a good business advisor is to be able to listen and actively listen, to listen to what someone's saying, and to some extent what they're not saying, and get a feel for what they actually need. Now, I mentioned a while ago in this session, people remember how they felt. If you meet an owner and they have a feeling that they could work with you, they'll know why and they'll remember that.
Mm.
So in terms of anyone, say if you like younger or developing, trust in yourself, be yourself, and take it a step at a time.
Nice, eh? Powerful ending. I like it. Well, we'll have the company website and your email and phone number. Hopefully it doesn't blow up too much. I don't imagine. So it's a trickle, the podcast. The TikTok and the others might be quite interesting. We'll see what happens. So, yeah, thank you.
You're welcome, Ryan. That's been fun.
Yeah, cool.